It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 902 for the 4th of October, 2024. This week, just as people have fingerprints, so do browsers. The fingerprint is what allows the browser to be tracked from site to site. If you find this disturbing, there are some ways to fight back. In short circuits, if you've ever posted something to Facebook and immediately received a like or a friend request from someone you don't know, it's probably yet another scourge that Facebook can't or won't do anything about. And ChronoQuest is a game that requires placing 6 historical events in the correct chronological order. It's amusing, but don't expect to learn any useful history by playing. When you direct your browser to a website, the website asks some questions before displaying anything. Some of the information requested is essential for the site to display properly, but additional questions may also be asked, and these allow commercial sites to track you all around the internet. Imagine an old department store with different areas operated by various business owners. The men's apparel area has a list of customers, as does the women's apparel area, the bookstore, the toy section, and the home furnishings department. Because it is a department store, the merchants probably all share their customer lists. Then the department store acquires a computer that can keep track of which people buy what items. Eventually, the store could track you from department to department and learn exactly what kinds of things you're interested in. That might be good for you. It would definitely be good for the merchants. Well, that is exactly what the internet allows merchants to do, but on a grand scale, far beyond anything individual merchants ever considered. So websites ask a lot of questions. They want to know what browser you're using, what the computer's screen size is, what the browser's window size is, your IP address, which typefaces are available to you, whether you're running an ad blocker, what kinds of video and audio files the browser can accept, where you are, and potentially a lot more. Many browsers respond to the "What browser are you?" with a standard response. Mozilla 5.0, Windows NT 10.0, Windows 64, Apple WebKit, KHTML like Gecko, Chrome, Safari, Edge. Most current browsers have few differences in how they interpret HTML and CSS code, so they can respond with that very standard, generic response. Screen size is more important. The presence of an ad blocker will be important for those who operate sites funded by ads. Your location could be important for restaurants and delivery services. In other words, the site has logical and ethical reasons for asking some of those questions. But some sites include code from other sites. There are reasonable and ethical reasons for doing that, too. The TechBiter Worldwide website loads some cascading stylesheet code and typefaces from external sources, such as jQuery. There are links to PayPal, Facebook, StatCounter, SiteLock, the W3 organization, StatCounter, Cloudflare, and Site24/7. None of those actually does any tracking. They just provide services and information for my use. Some web pages include content from external domains and may use cookies and other methods to track your browsing habits, often to display advertisements. The domains that do that are called third-party trackers. Do not track and global privacy control settings already exist, and setting these in your browser's configuration settings would keep sites from tracking you, if they responded honestly and accurately. Few do. Regardless of the settings, sites that want to track you will track you. You might be surprised by the amount of information that can be coaxed from your browser. It's important to understand that none of this information is personally identifiable. The most it can do is identify your browser with high reliability. Visit device info, You'll find a link on the TechBiter Worldwide website, and you'll see information about your computer's operating system, the browser, the computer's public IP address, unless you're using a VPN, possibly the browser's location, what time zone you're in, microphone and speaker information, camera permissions, Bluetooth support, installed fonts, browser plugins, screen resolution, and yes, more, a lot more. Another site to visit is the Browser Fingerprint Study site, and you'll find a link to that on the TechBiter Worldwide website. This is a project by security and privacy researchers at the Friedrich Alexander University in Germany. It has been in operation since 2016, and you can create an account there that allows you to track your browser's ability to be identified over time. You'll receive an email reminder once a week to check the browser. Signing up is optional, and you can check the browser's fingerprint whether you want to participate or not. And then swing by the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Cover Your Tracks site. This is a good site to visit with each of your browsers because you'll see that built-in protection against tracking varies. Beyond that, these sites show the most commonly used metrics that are combined to establish a browser's unique fingerprint. I found that Vivaldi's user agent information is common. About 1 in 21 browsers will report that exact value. Screen size and color depth are also pretty common, 1 in 30 browsers. But further down, we see hashes of the Canvas fingerprint and the WebGL fingerprint, 1 in 32,500 browsers, and 1 in 39,000 browsers use those exact values. So when these specifications are considered in aggregate form, it's trivial to identify a specific browser. It would then seem to be at least theoretically possible for an organization that has uniquely identified your browser to link the browser to you if you subscribe to something, buy something, request more information, or perform any other action that gives the site operator your name, address, and other information. If you'd prefer not to have people you don't know track you from site to site all over the internet, you can pay for utilities such as the Avast AntiTrack, $55 a year, or $65 for up to 10 Apple and Windows devices. Or there's Norton AntiTrack for $50 a year. They charge $35 for the first year. Each of these defeats fingerprinting by lying. They inject false information into the data stream. That's a procedure I don't particularly like, and having to pay someone to have my browser lie is even less appealing. I like the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Privacy Badger, a free browser extension for Firefox and Chrome-based browsers. Instead of lying to sites that ask inappropriate questions, Privacy Badger knows which sites aren't trustworthy, and if a site isn't on the good list or the bad list, it makes decisions based on the site's behavior. It looks for tracking techniques like uniquely identifying cookies, local storage of super cookies, and Canvas fingerprinting. And if it observes a single third-party host tracking you on three separate sites, Privacy Badger will automatically disallow content from that third-party tracker. The Electronic Frontier Foundation explains Privacy Badger's operation this way. Privacy Badger is an algorithmic tracker blocker. We define what tracking looks like, and then Privacy Badger blocks or restricts domains that it observes tracking in the wild. What is and isn't considered a tracker is entirely based on how a specific domain acts and not on human judgment. I like that approach. Privacy Badger shouldn't be confused with ad blockers. Although it may block some ads, that occurs simply as a result of actions to stop trackers. It focuses on disallowing visible and invisible third-party scripts or images that appear to be tracking you, even though you specifically denied consent by sending Do Not Track and Global Privacy Control signals. Most of these third-party trackers are advertisements. When you see an ad, the ad sees you, and it can track you. Privacy Badger stops that. To download Privacy Badger, use the Electronic Frontier Foundation page of the Google Play Store for Chrome-based browsers, and download the extension from EFF for Firefox. You'll find links to both of those on the TechBiter Worldwide website. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, when it comes to protecting users, Facebook always seems to be several miles behind the scammers. Because I want friends to be able to share any of my posts that they like, I make the posts public. The downside to that policy is that posts tend to attract barnacles. I posted a photo in mid-September and had a like within seconds from a phony account that claimed to be Juliana Wendell. She claims to be from Amsterdam. Her profile says she now lives in Knoxville. She also says, "I believe in God and his timing," whatever that's supposed to mean. The banner picture appears to be AI-generated, and the profile picture definitely is, unless Juliana Wendell has a 16-inch waist and 48-inch hips. The photos depict someone who is substantially more clothed than is common for these kinds of fake accounts, and the use of AI-generated images is relatively new. Previously, scammers simply stole images of actual people from wherever they could find them. The fake account didn't immediately ask me to send it a friend request, but that probably would have followed eventually. So far, the scammer has one friend. And based on a quick examination of the account, that guy seems to be of the gullible type. My response? Well, I clicked the three dots and reported the fake account as scam, fraud, or impersonation. I selected the financial or identity scam option, but that's based solely on a guess. The pretty ladies, who may actually be named Boris and live in a suburb of Moscow, usually entice their new friends and then find some reason to ask them for money. Someone could develop a long con by asking for small amounts and then quickly repaying them to build up trust, and then request a substantial amount, after which she would disappear with the Mark's money. Anyway, after reporting the account, I blocked it. This is a widespread problem on Facebook, and it almost seems like Facebook doesn't want to fix it. It's either that or there are no competent programmers working there. These accounts are created and run by bots until they attract enough fools, and I'd like to think that Facebook could institute closer monitoring of new accounts. Until Facebook determines that it is worthwhile to take out the trash, users will have to do it for them. It's up to us to identify fake accounts, report them, and block them. Users with no profile picture or pictures of semi-clothed people are immediately suspect. Women will be presented photos of men. Men will see pictures of women. The names are often obviously fake. AI images, so far, are almost always identifiable. That will change over time. Brand new accounts with zero or few friends should be treated with extreme caution. If the account has few or no posts, consider there's a very high likelihood of fraud. When you identify posts that have received likes from fake accounts, delete the likes by reporting the fake account and blocking it. Facebook rarely responds to these accounts, so it's hard to tell if someone or some algorithm has actually taken any action. It's far more frustrating and time-consuming than it should be, but these actions are essential for our own security and that of our friends. I've been playing a game called Chrono Quest for more than 2 years, usually about 5:30 in the morning, and every day it reminds me of a really bad history class, one that concentrates solely on dates. There's a main game and a bonus game that's offered if you win the main game. Winning involves placing 6 historical events in the correct chronological order in 3 or fewer tries. I solve about 60% in 2 tries, 28% in 1 try, and 12% in 3 tries. Occasionally, I fail the main game. I get the bonus game in two tries about 55% of the time, in a single try around 33% of the time, and in three tries about 12% of the time. So I enjoy the game, but it certainly doesn't teach anything about history. Sometimes four of the six events occur in a span of 20 years in the 1800s. Those are difficult. It's even worse when three or four of the events occur in a clump before the 1400s. One game started with all the events in the right order, and after looking at it for a while, I just clicked the Check Answers button. A friend and I share our results each day, along with the unlikely summaries of the events depicted. His strategy usually involves taking the time to think about the relationships of the events. My approach involves just slapping the six events into an order that seems plausible and then checking the results. We have similar win-loss ratios, and sometimes we write weirdly similar summaries. If I get four of the six right on the first try, winning on the second go is guaranteed. And when I get three of the six right, it is statistically impossible to lose, although I have managed to do it. The real challenges occur when you get zero or one right on the first try. Play ChronoQuest, and you may find it amusing and sometimes frustrating, but never educational, because learning just dates eliminates any contextual information. Understanding why something happened is far more important, along with who was involved and what the consequences were. Simply memorizing dates discourages critical thinking. True historical knowledge requires analyzing sources, evaluating perspectives, and understanding motivations behind historical actions. ChronoQuest does nothing to link the history to current problems, and concentrating on dates eliminates the struggles, achievements, and experiences of those who lived the events. Knowing what else was happening in 1938 is more important than learning Superman comic books were first published then, or knowing where titanium comes from, how it's used, and why it's important is more useful than just knowing it was discovered in 1791. So ChronoQuest can be fun. Just don't expect to learn anything by playing it. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.